shoreline. The only illuminations were the merry lights of the ship and the sombre philosophical lights of God above. Otherwise, the land ahead was favoured only by darkness. A confident brushstroke of rich, black ink. I had been in an excellent mood for days, having picked the winner of the Middle Park Stakes at Nottingham. Every so often, I stuck a hand in my right pocket and jingled part of my winnings in the shape of a few half-crowns. The rest of it was inserted into an inside pocket of my uniform. A fold of lovely, crisp, white banknotes. I'd got up to Nottingham on a brief furlough, having been given a length of time not quite long enough to justify the long trek across England and Ireland to Sligo. France had fallen to Hitler, and suddenly, bizarrely, colonies like the Gold Coast were surrounded by the new enemy, the forces of the Vichy French. No one knew what was going to happen, but we were being shunted down quickly to be in place, to blow up bridges, burst canals and break up roads, if the need arose. We had heard the colonial regiments were being swelled by new recruits, thousands of Gold Coast men rushing to defend the Empire. I suppose this was when Tom Quay, though of course I didn't know him then, joined up. So I was standing there, flush with my winnings, not thinking of much, as always somewhat intoxicated by being at sea, somewhat in love with an unknown coastline and the intriguing country lying in behind. I had also about a bottle of Scotch whisky in me, though I stood rooted as a tree for all that. It was a moment of simple exhilaration. My red hair, the self-same red hair that had first brought me to the attention of May. For it was not I who said hello to her first, but she, with her playful question in the simple, neat quadrangle of the university. "I suppose you put a colour in that." My red hair was brushed flat back from my forehead, my second lieutenant's cap holding it down like a pot lid. My cheeks had been shaved by my batman, Percy Welsh. My underclothes were starched. My trousers were creased. My shoes were signalling back brightly to the moon, when suddenly the whole port side of the ship seemed to go up right in front of my eyes, an enormous gush and geyser of water, a shuddering explosion, an ear-numbing rip of metallic noise, and a vast red cornet of flames the size of the torch on the Statue of Liberty. The young second lieutenant from Donegal was suddenly as dead as one of those porpoises you see washed up on the beach of Enniscrone after a storm, on the deck beside me, felled by a jagged missile of stray metal. Men came tearing up from below, the doorways oozing them out as if so much boiling molasses. There were cries and questions even as the gigantic fountain of displaced water collapsed and found the deck and hammered us flat there, as if we were blobs of dough. Two of my sappers were trying to peel me back up from the deck, itself splintered and cratered from the force, and now other stray bits of the ship rained down, clattering and banging and boasting and killing. "That was a fucking torpedo," said my sergeant with perfect redundancy. A little man called Ned Johns from Cornwall, the most knowledgeable man for a fuse I ever worked with. He probably knew the make and poundage of the torpedo, but if he did, he didn't say. The next second, the huge ship started to pitch to port, and before I could grab him, Ned Johns went off, sliding down the new slope and smashing into the rail, gathered himself, stood up, looked back at me, and then was wrenched across the rail and out of view. I knew we were holed deep under the waterline. I could more or less feel it in my body. Something vital torn out of the ship echoed in the pit of my stomach. Some mischief done. Deep, deep in some engine room or cargo hold. My other helper, Johnny Fats Talbot, a man so lean you could have used him for spare wires, as poor Ned Johns once said, in truth, was using me now as a kind of bollard. But that was no good, because the ship seemed to make a delayed reaction to its wound and shuddered upward. The ship's rail rearing up 10 feet in a bizarre and impossible movement, catching poor Johnny completely off guard, since he'd been bracing himself against a force from the other direction, and off he